Pro Tools Expert Podcast is brought to you with the support of Groove 3. Here is Russ Hughes.
Can I say an enormous thank you first to Russ from RSPE? Somebody said to me, how did we get a room at NAMM in 2 weeks' notice? Well, it was Russ doing what Russ does. So thanks, mate. Appreciate it. Let's just give him a round of applause for that. Also, you will notice we're in a room that's set up to sell stuff and to show stuff. These guys have given up the next hour or so that we can do this. So that's really appreciated. We really want to say thank you to Triad Orbit. I don't know if you've seen these stands. If you ever wonder what will happen if there's a nuclear bomb drop on your studio, these are the mic stands that will survive it. I've just been taking a look at them. They are just utterly awesome. They've got some really... Cliff is now my hostess doing the demo for me. That's fantastic. Go and check them out please. Go to the back of back of this room and check out the Triad Orbit stuff. It's just awesome, awesome gear. It's not only about that it's built like a tank, but also you can put these mics into virtually every permutation you could think of. So you could put two mics right next to each other because these legs change angles and stuff. So check them out. Thank you, Triad Orbit, for giving up your time this afternoon and giving us this room at short notice. We really appreciate that. Can we say thank you to them as well, please? Because some of those guys are in the room. Thank you. I would like to introduce the panel this afternoon. The plan of this is that we've got a load of questions that have come in. We can take them from the floor as well, but we've had some stuff emailed in. I'm Russ Hughes. I'm the editor of Pro Tools Expert. We are, I think I'm safe in saying, the number one independent Pro Tools site out there. And we have a fantastic partnership with our friends over at Avid. So I'm going to introduce Tom Graham first. You've been at Avid for, is it too long to mention?
Yeah, 19 years.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So Tom is a practitioner first. He's been around studios and recording and stuff. But he's here today because, of course, there's the amazing talk about bomb drops. We've also got the Starship Enterprise down on your stand in the form of the S6 control surface. I got that right. I didn't call it a console.
That was very good.
That was very good. So if you haven't checked it out, check it out. But talk to Tom. Tom is, it's his baby. So he's been working with the dev team at Avid to get this out to the market. Russ has been working with lots of houses who have already bought them. So it's been hugely successful already, Tom, hasn't it? Even before it's almost out.
It's pretty exciting. It comes from years of asking engineers what they're looking for, what they would do differently with, say, Icon or System 5. And the modularity, the color coding, the ergonomics, it really is what we think is the next step. And the market has responded. They're very excited about it.
Great. Yeah. But of course, the big thing is that Tom's at Avid, and he is obviously part of the team for Pro Tools. And I think Pro Tools is, for most of us, the de facto standard. Whether you like that or not, it's the industry standard. And I like it.
I love it.
And that's why we do Pro Tools Expert.
Fantastic.
Because we're fans of it.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. On Tom's left, we have Gary Lux.
Hello.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
Yeah, tell us a bit about yourself, Gary, for those.
Well, first, I just want to say hello, and Mick Kazowski was supposed to be here. He is at Grammy rehearsal with Daft Punk. I in no way, I'm just substituting for him. I certainly do not replace him, but I'm happy to be here for Mick. And I've been a mixer, a scoring mixer, a record mixer for a long time, and I'm very excited to be here. I'm also very excited about the new format that Avid has for their S6. I'm excited to get mine.
Fantastic. Now, to my right is Mr. Air EQ, Airband. We're going to talk about that later because we're all a bit flummoxed by that at times, but it's the EQ, you know that, not because you're sat next to me, but the EQ I reach for a lot now is your EQ4, which is just an utterly brilliant piece of kit, and it won the People's Choice Award on Pro Tools Expert this year. So, but more than that, we Cliff Magg, appreciate you being here today, and your genius.
Thank you. I appreciate being here. I'm just happy to be among all of you guys. I respect you all so much.
And on the end here, I think needs no introduction, but we really do love Colin from Mac DSP. If I'm not reaching for your EQ, then I'm reaching for your compressors, because Colin is a bit of a genius, and we'll probably get some comedy gold from you today, sir, because we can always rely on you to put things in a way that no one else can, sir. How are you?
I'm good. I didn't bring any gold, and yeah. Howdy. I'm going to stop talking now. Back to Russ.
So this is if you've got questions to ask, we'll get one off from here, from stuff we've had emailed into to Pro Tools HQ, Pro Tools Expert HQ. You've got Pro Tools HQ at your place, but okay, here's a good starter. Actually, I'm going to throw it across. We'll go right to left on this on my side. Colin, what motivates you to do what you do? This is from Arnold in Glasgow in the UK.
What motivates me? I'm a very bad musician and not so great of an audio engineer either. But there are some small parts of the process that I seem to obsess and compulse about in a productive way. And the ideas seem to work, so it's kind of exciting. You know, I'm not going to be a rock star and I'm not going to be the guy getting the Grammy, but I'm quite happy to make some tool that people will like, and I can go to the NAMM show and people will give me a hug and a butt slap and go, "Yeah, man, that's awesome." And I go, "Do I know you? I don't have any friends, I think, on my Facebook page that wear leather pants. Just saying. But okay, yeah." So it's fun. So I like my job and I want to keep doing it. I'm done. You're up, Cliff.
Cliff, yeah. Talk about what motivates you.
The thing that motivated me from the very beginning is just, it's so cliche, but it's the music, it's the sound, it's the feeling that I used to get when I'd listen to music and songs that I'd hear on the radio. And I can hear some of those songs today, and it brings me back to that time that was back in the 60s. 64, in 64, I was thinking last night, I figured you might ask about, you know, why that would... affect me so much. I can still remember when I was about 14 years old, I was picking cherries on a cherry farm to make my living as a young kid to be able to buy his stuff. And I can still remember the Beach Boys songs and all of the things that were playing on my little transistor radio that I had at that time.
Musical snapshots.
Yep, and it happens. You can just pick them out from one place to another. The songs that do that to you. That's what motivated me to get involved in the recording.
Tom.
So I was a recording engineer out of college and really enjoyed being around musicians and recording them and putting real musicians in a room, and was always fascinated by the technology. And moved to California and worked in sales of the kit and learning the workflows. And I got to meet so many great people that I see out here, and got interested in Pro Tools. At the time, it was version 2, and edited some of my own music and thought, this is the future. This is what I want to be a part of. And for me, the motivation is really meeting just some of the coolest people. In fact, I wrote a blog about doing a NAMM in 2001 where I demoed Pro Control to Stevie Wonder and put his hands on the console. And Gil, my counterpart, was demoing the Control 24 to Ray Charles. And just though being around great people and such talented people who use our tools to create, it's inspiring.
Gary.
I know what got me into this. You know, it was always about the music. I think we find these days it's challenging. I think this is what the real question is. We knew what the motivation was a long time ago as to why we got into it. Why we still do this is really the challenge of it all. It's very difficult. Coming to a NAMM show and seeing our friends is really the greatest part of this whole thing. Seeing the gear is one thing, but seeing the people. And the way we used to do sessions, just regular television and orchestra dates, 30, 40, 50 people every session, it's not that way anymore. So I think it's very challenging to be motivated to keep going. That being said, I love what I do now, you know, more than ever. The tools are great. I feel fearless when I do it. We just need to do more of it.
Fantastic. Here's a question then. This is, we'll go left to right then. Are you ready? You'll be first up this time, Gary. And we'll see if we go. I want to get into this is from Tim at Salt Lake City. That's in the United States, I think, isn't it? It is, yes. Okay. Yeah. Just checking. I want to get into the recording industry. What advice would you give to people trying to get into the industry? Should I go to college or should I get a job in a studio?
Well, you know, I do mentor a lot of kids. A lot of this comes my way. A lot of people come to me, Gary, my son, my daughter wants to be like you. What should they do? One of the first things I have them do is I want them to go to the Conservatory of Recording Arts in Arizona. I think that that would make them compliant. They would go through a program, and it would certainly prove to them whether they really liked it or not. If they didn't like it, they could certainly go to college after that. And I think it would prove a stick-to-itiveness of something that they should do. Back in my day, we got a job as a runner, an assistant, where it really meant something, where you worked for an independent studio and you went through the ranks and you really had something to show for yourself. And engineers were very willing to share with you because you proved yourself. And that is not the way it is anymore. It's tough to get a gig in a commercial studio where you can really grow and really come out of it. That's the way I grew up, you know, with it. So it's a tough format now on how to get into it.
Gary, was it for you the same? There's a lot of studios in the UK where what we found was we were T-boys that one day the tape-op didn't show up, so then we tape-oped.
Oh,
and then one day the engineer didn't show up, so then we ended up an engineer. So some producers that are out there were the T-boy on the day that the producer couldn't make it.
Absolutely.
Is that the way it happened in a lot of
that
places?
That was the case for me. I was an assistant at Evergreen Studios way back. They said, Gary, we need you to go in and put up and make a cassette mix. Go put up the tape. Don't screw anything up. And I went, I did, I put up a fader, I put up another fader, and I'm going, this is all the time I really want to be in the music business. And I started putting up faders, and I said, I am the bass player. I am the drummer. I am the singer. And the light bulbs went on for me. And so that was my aha moment. I don't know if that happens anymore for young guys where they can hang around with guys like Dave and Frank and myself and learn.
Colin, college or go and get a job in a studio? What was it for you?
I mentioned before I'm not really a good musician or audio engineer person, so I'm not sure I'm fully qualified to answer it from the pushing the faders path. And I think mostly hands-on experience seems to be the way that most of the really good engineers who are in the studios have, you know, gotten their chops. Is they may have gone to school, but it seems that the practical studio work, the interpersonal stuff, is what, you know, got them to understand what it was going to take, and they buckled down and did it. If you're going to actually make the gear, then I'd sound like my father and say you're going to go to college and you're going to take all these math classes and yada yada yada. And to that end, I would tell anyone that if you don't think you can do math or something, I would take you outside and give you a swift kick in the jimmies, because if you can make music, which is a very subjective and challenging process, you know, making gear, I have to say, is easier because it's only one thing. And you can obsess and compulse about the one thing and the one thing it does and until you have the eureka moment and make it good. And that's a lot easier than like having to battle with egos and tracks and faders and tapes and tea makers and producers who don't show up and all the other variability that goes on with music production. But if you're going to make some gear, you can pretty much, you know, abscond yourself away and go get a degree in electrical engineering or something like that, maybe focus on signal processing, and you can do it. And if you have a passion for music, it'll all come back around full circle, and then you'll have a bad haircut and cheap glasses and wear a collared shirt to the NAMM show. I'm going to stop now.
Thank you on behalf of the politically correct there for that fantastic Colin bass. Tom, were you college or were you there making tea and stuff and running around a studio? Or
well,
which route did you
take? It's actually funny you should say that, because I got a four-year degree in a sound recording program. It was, you had to audition to get in, so you had to have a music major. And I, you know, physics and calculus and all this stuff and acoustics. And then I get to my internship at the recording studio, and the guy says, here's the weed whacker and the two-cycle oil. You mix a little bit of the two-cycle oil. Once you're done with the parking lot, I'm going to have you work on painting the basement. I said, I'm here to intern. He said, yeah, this is the two-cycle engine. You weed whack this way. And so ultimately, even if you do go that way, the tried and true route is the T-boy. Is you have to start at the bottom. You have to become, and really, you learn the ropes of how studios work. You learn what you can say to whom, and you know, there's a protocol and the whole thing. I will say this, though. Look, in this day and age that we live in, it has shifted and changed in the sense that the technology, you have to understand and be on the cutting edge technology. This man right here has been in the business a long time, but yet he's the first one to knock on my door to say, I need to sit at this S6. I need to learn this and figure out this technology because I know this is going to make me better, make me more productive, and I have to know it. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword of you know, do we go the route of the studio and pick it up? Interesting thing a guy said to me in the record business once. He said, if you're kind of picking a career path, you're going to do that no matter what. You have to have the burning desire in you that this is what I'm going to do, and you'll stick with it, as you were saying, Gary. And that means mixing the two-cycle oil, weed whacking for as long as it takes to get your chance and do that. And I would say learn the technology. Stay on it as much as you possibly can.
I may make myself slightly unpopular here, but I sometimes go and teach in colleges, and I walk into these colleges with kids on the first year of their course, and they all describe themselves first to me as producers. I do explain to them that actually you need to produce something before you're a producer. But there seems we have quite an entitled generation now. I see it running a blog and in social media and all of that. Do you think there's something that they need to learn that you do have to start at the bottom? Even if you come out of, some of them come out of college after 4 years and think, okay, now I'm George Martin. Where's my control room? Let me loose. Is there an expectation sometimes that college puts on these kids that they're going to walk into the top studio and get on with it?
I think it is. It is a bit of the generation, and unfortunately, Mike Shipley, who passed away this past year, said to me that you know there was a mentorship that happened where I would go into a studio and someone would take me under their wing, and they would start to show me the difference mic positions could make. And there was this transfer of knowledge and this nurturing that's going on. I don't know that there's as much of that before because the industry has changed a lot.
You know, I think with the technology today, it's terrific. In the hands of the right people, the technology swings. However, things have been made to be so easy that mediocrity is malignant. In music making, everyone feels that they're a producer because they're making a beat. Someone is doing this. They have no melody. We sound like old guys here when we say that we've come from the bottom up. But, I mean, truly, that's the way it was. There was a rite of passage. There was an internship. There was a lot of doing stuff. But then you got information from great guys because you put your time in. That's the way it is.
Can I come to Cliff for a moment? Because Cliff, I saw you on Dave Pensado's show last year, coming here from NAMM at the Avid booth, and you were genuinely moved when you talked about this next generation of producers, and it was palpable just from a video. You have a real passion about young people and music, don't you, and getting them into the industry. What's your view on this? Because I almost feel like you're a kind of father figure wanting to guide them through this rite of passage.
Well, I believe... The first thing I have to start with is I'll never forget the first day that I stepped in the first studio I ever stepped in. And I'll bet you that every one of you guys, and most of you guys, I know you, Dave, know the first studio you went into and what that did to you. The first one I stepped into, they pulled up a Dave Mason 16-track tape. And I couldn't believe it was one of my... I love Dave Mason and, James Gang Rides Again and all that happened back in the 80s and, the 70s. And I'll never forget when they broke down the multi-track and I heard Dave's voice alone and I heard all of those things combined back together. I didn't even know what recording was until I saw and heard that. It had a huge impact in my life. I could think of nothing else. Before that, I was building homes. I was a contractor building homes. I wasn't a recording engineer, but I loved music, and the passion for writing and being involved in it, I couldn't put down. And I know that there are many young engineers that are out there that if they have that driving passion that drives us to do the things we have to do to be able to do that, to be able to record, to be able to buy a 24-track tape recorder, to be able to buy a half-inch two-track ATR-100, and to be able to buy a C-12, or to buy those things that gave you the key things that you could start to record with. Those are great things to start to record with if you got the chance to. But it took that drive that led to be able to get those things, to be able to record, and to be able to learn from the people like you're talking about that taught me along the way. But it was that drive that kept me learning and kept me trying to do better and to get things better than they are. And that's what I think that all the kids,
I would guess most people need. Most of us had some form of basic four-track cassette, or whatever you could start on.
I had a 244
80-8.
Yeah, that was my starter.
you have that drive, and you know, I was lucky enough to be able to foster it and go to college and learn some of that, and then learn from some masters there, and then go recording studios and learn there, and. You have to have the passion. You have to have the burning desire that's what you're going to do.
It's the key.
Because it's a rough road. It's not an easy road.
There wasn't any studio waiting for me to come in. I had to build my own studio to be able to come in.
Sure.
And I didn't know a darn thing about it.
Other and that's
than
much more doable now with technology, right?
It's much more doable.
But I'm
with Gary on this. There's a bad equation that goes on in the heads of young people today that because you have a piece of software that you can do almost anything with, that means that you are a craftsman with it. It doesn't. That's like saying if you have Photoshop that you're Van Gogh, and it's exactly the wrong correlation. So having a craft and doing that. We've got a question here, which is really interesting. Actually, you just gave quite a serious shopping list there, which most of us would like to have had and like to have owned. But we'll start with you, Colin. The question is, this is from Martin in Germany, Bonn. Is there one piece of studio gear, and it can't be yours, that stood out during your recording career? We'll brag on you.
Right. Well, so because I was a bad musician and not such a great audio engineer, I've mentioned that
every time.
Did
you play the drums then?
No, keyboards. Don't start. But once I was left alone, I don't think it was late. People were getting a late dinner or something. And I just wanted to play with a compressor. I can't tell you what compressor it was or any of that, but I couldn't believe that you could, like, take, I don't know, the snare drum and get all these different tones out of it if you squash the crap out of it or played with the attack and release and the ratio. So I just sat there and did that. And then I soloed the vocal track and started doing the same kind of stuff till by the time everyone came back, I'd screwed up everything. But I was like, this is amazing. These compressors, it changes the sound. This is so cool. And I, you know, at that point, pushed every fader and turned every knob and the whole thing. And I was kicked out of that band pretty quick after that. But that was the most memorable experience because I was like, wow. Because at first I was like, why do we have to compress? It'll be fine. And then I realized that, oh. And then at that point, I also had a lot more respect for that guy behind the console pushing the faders. Like, oh, he's a smart guy. No wonder we sound so good. After the fact, except when you put up my parts, which we seem to have muted now, but that's okay. So anyway, so we were just playing with a compressor for probably a couple of hours. Like, people went out and got dinner and beer, and I screwed it all up, but I had a great time and kind of lost that gig from that. But I learned that equipment is cool, and then I wanted a lot of it, and so it began.
I'm interested. Is squash the crap out of it one of the presets in your plugins?
Oh, that could be.
Noted.
Let's get in there. Colin, squash the crap out of it. We need those settings that got you making. It's interesting, actually. I must say that what you're known for in my world is your compressors are some of the best out there. And actually, it's interesting that your passion was compressors first, which is kind of, it's just a happy accident?
Happy accident. You know, I think I'm just...
You haven't intentionally done that.
Not
squashing
intentionally.
The crap out of
it. I just like it. I mean, I think it's interesting that, manipulating the dynamic response of a signal can really change your impression of it. That's just... And I guess best layman's terms I can tell you. I mean, it's ratio, attack, topology, number of stages, key filter, yada yada yada. Who cares? It's all when you apply it to that signal, it changes it, and it goes from like, that's a pretty good vocal to now it's a vocal with power. And you're like, wow, okay, hey, I did that, and I'm in that preset to squash the crap out of it. I did the crap part. Yeah, I'm done. Do you have any gold? Okay. Sorry.
Cliff, out of that shopping list, it probably wasn't even on that shopping list you just mentioned before. What, is there a piece of gear that for you had a seminal moment in your recording career?
Yes, there's one that stands out for me, and it does because for me, it is a very important part in any recording, to me anyway, is the vocal. And I had good microphones, but I remember I was working real hard to get a vocal sound that was happening back in the late 80s, in the 80s and 70s, early 80s. And I kept trying and trying, and a friend of mine, his name is Chubba, he said, and I keep sending these vocals, and I had my preamp that was in my console, and I had my best mic I had, and I had my best compressor I had at the time, and I couldn't make it happen. Let me try this. And it went on, and he gave me one point of advice. He said, I want you to get these three things. The first thing on that list was an AKG C12 Stephen Paul mod with a 1.5 micron element. That's where the airband came from, and I'm telling you why it came from that. That's why it was the most important piece of equipment to me, because I understood what air was supposed to be in a vocal and what it was supposed to sound like. I knew what it was supposed to sound like now. Before, I had no idea. So when I got through and I had these three great pieces, I had a console that was lacking in preamps, lacking in EQs, lacking in any compression that was right. And so I had to come up with something, a preamp, that would match what I was able to do with the C12. And with that, I had a whole drawer full of microphones that didn't have air. And I knew from my experience with the EQs and that we could put some air on those microphones in that preamp. And we developed our own preamps from that very thing. So the C12 is responsible, in my opinion, for where any airband preamp EQ came from. And the EQ came from, the airband EQ came from the preamp.
Can I say, we're going to do it now. This isn't an advert. We agreed on this, I'd brag on you guys today for you because I love all what you do, all the gear you make. This airband, we have questions into the blog. 40K at the top.
Yeah.
I've got a dog.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah?
He hates it.
He loves the airband, but a lot of people are thinking, well, it's 40K. How the heck does that work? 40K.
Okay.
You add it in. It yep. shouldn't work.
Yeah, it shouldn't.
How's it working?
Well, what it does, and if you'll just imagine, at 40K, I just boosted it at 10 dB. So on the curve as it comes down from the boost, you're going to hear the tail end of whatever I decide that slope is going to be. So to be able to hear that, sometimes you'll have to take 40K, and you're going to have to gain it up high enough that you can hear just that little bit of end. It'll get out of the sibilance. It may get, you know, it may add the thing that you need on the strings rather than taking it down to 10K and boosting what goes down to 25K. You see what I mean?
Yeah,
so
that
it's
makes
where
sense.
You put that slope.
Now you said that, it makes
and if
sense.
And if we and that's as far out as you could move it where it would that we can hear it.
So basically that tail, the further it comes down the frequency spectrum, the less is applied. Hence the airband.
Exactly. And the trick is to be able to do that without that becoming a hiss switch.
Yes.
And the hiss band.
I was going to say that, yeah. Okay. Gary, what was that bit of gear for you? Is there one bit of gear that you think, that changed it?
The gear wasn't the thing for me. I've always been a musician.
Yeah.
And so people think that, you know, because you're an engineer, you know, you could fix things. And so I have no idea what goes on underneath the console. I don't know red from green from blue, but I know when someone's sharp or flat. And so the magic for me is always, you know, is how I manipulate the sound musically. That being said, I think the piece of gear that's the most important for me is the console. I'm such an organization freak. I have to organize things. I have to be able to, you know, hit one button to turn everything off instead of mousing my way to off, on. And so I organize myself. I love my VCAs. I love my consoles. And anything that can keep me in the sweet spot, which I'm going to get now, and, is a lot of fun. So for me, the consoles, I can't mix with a mouse. I can adjust things, but... That's my piece of gear.
I could feel Tom's spirit dropping as you said you didn't know green from red from blue and they worked so hard to get the colours right on the S6.
I don't even know who he is. Oh, yeah, well.
Okay. Yeah, Tom.
I still read drums, guitar, bass, and I don't have to do the colour thing.
Tom, is there a bit of gear that you think, yeah, that was for me something that I just kept bringing into sessions and stuff. And
I'm going to answer it in the negative first, and then I'll give you the positive.
Cool. Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of young kids today, or certain people, tend to glorify analog recording. Now, it has some great elements to it, for sure. Now, if you didn't have Dolby A or Dolby SR in your studio like I didn't, and if you had I had a JH-600 and an MCI console and, you know, somewhat noisy patch bays, and in the days of Rev 7s where they were always outputting noise, you know, noise and print through and, you know, splicing 2-inch tape, these are challenges that I don't think the modern young guy can or gal can grasp so much unless you lived it.
They look back through rose-tinted spectacles.
That's right.
Because they didn't have to deal with it.
Right. So for me, it's multi-track recording is the piece of gear. Now, that being said, 2-inch tape, you know, 456, oxide coming off. I mean, we could just go on for days about the challenges of analog recording. And I don't care how good you were. You cut half-inch masters, you're nervous. You're sitting there with the razor blade. You're like, I know this is going to work. I know it. I've done this 100 times.
I still have a cut from the Blues
wasn't self-harm.
Brothers movie. I still have it there. It was a bad time. I made the wrong cut.
So for me, it's Pro Tools. I mean, it's so obvious, but the moment I saw, I'll tell you a quick story. So I was one of the first guys to do Pro Tools on a scoring stage where you're recording the orchestra, and the composer asked me, he said, you think we're crazy? Can we actually record 48 tracks of, you know, orchestra? And I'm like, no, I think we can do it. And he's like, but you know how expensive this is with an orchestra? I'm like, yeah, I think we can do it. So when I did the first edit where they, you know, they played from bar 1 to 20, and then they made a mistake, and then they picked it up from bar 19 to, and I cut them together on the scoring stage. Everybody stopped and applauded because they had never done that ever before. They had to wait until editorial after the pieces were mixed to string it together. And they're like, and then when they heard the first cue go into the second cue, they were like, what? So that's, I mean, Pro Tools for me in multi-track, non-linear, non-destructive editing and crossfades was just, it was magical.
Well, you stole my thunder because I was going to do that for you.
Because I'm sorry.
The reason it would come as no surprise to you guys that the reason I run Pro Tools Expert is Pro Tools changed my life as a writer, as a composer, as an engineer, as a producer. And not because I can fix mistakes. That's the big mistake people make about digital recording, that you can basically composite everything back together afterwards. But because suddenly, and the other thing you most people forget about Pro Tools is it works for those of us in the analog world like a mixing desk and a tape machine. The signal flow made sense to me straight away.
Same as me.
Two
I
screens.
Looked at it the first time, I go, I get this.
Yeah. I didn't need to go and figure out where folders were and stuff like that. Right. Anyway, any questions from the floor before we come back to stuff that's been emailed in? Anybody got a burning question they want to ask this fantastic panel of people? Anybody? We'll think about it and we'll get a question from there. And when I come back in a minute, you can ask them what their favorite pudding is.
Tom, I'm going to change my favorite thing. I have to agree with you. Pro Tools, I couldn't be in business without it. But I know that the other that we had early on, we could have never developed, you know, something different that we did.
No,
but
and
I could not live without it.
Absolutely.
I can't live without it either.
Yeah.
You know, it makes us fearless in what we do.
Oh,
however,
man.
It adds to the neurosis. There's no decision-making going on.
Yeah.
No
yeah.
one,
so,
you know, how about so, the vocal? When we had 16 tracks or 24 tracks,
we
had to make a decision.
I
went crazy with the Manhattan Transfer.
Okay,
and did that punch work?
Okay, yes. I've got a question.
Sorry, I just punched a hole in your solo.
I'm going to
do it again.
Before we turn this into a podcast sponsored by Avid, because we're all loving on your product. It's a great product. There's no doubt about it. But here's a question. I'm going to start with you, Gary, because it sounds like I know what the answer's coming.
I'm pissed off right now.
No, I've got the question coming.
I'm getting angry. Go ahead.
Go for it. You'll like this one then. Okay. All this fixing in the mix crap that's going on these days.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
You think it's a good thing, or do you think people should commit at the start, get the EQ right, the compressor right, or do you think get it down clean and then fix it later?
Listen, you know, everybody gets what they get. If they have it in their heart, they're going to get it. But certain people have to make decisions if they know that the take is no good. It's just no good. Why are we going to save 90 vocals just to hear crap later?
Yeah.
So I mean, I still use my decision making from when we had few tracks, even though I still have the luxury of keeping a few. This is still performance driven.
It's discipline.
It's still performance driven. If you want to spend more time going over crap and stuff, then do it. But if I know something, I'm not going to keep it. I just get rid of it and move on.
Because we got to the, I can't name the artist because there's an artist I was going to talk about now that actually I know that on the entire album they went breath by breath, note by note, taking each bit in Pro Tools and then comping it all together later. I don't think that's music.
Well, there's no question about it that you can do some incredible things. There's no question about it. But again, it adds to the neurosis of everything. I'm fearless on Pro Tools. I love it. You know, I don't have to look for that blue piece of tape, which is tails, which is heads on all the edits that we've made and stuff. But,
Colin, because you said you were squashing the crap out of stuff that got you sacked. Are you a commit guy or fix it later?
Oh, geez.
Because people can do what they like with your gear.
I'll answer it maybe two ways. One, if someone wants to track with a lot of compression maybe, I'm kind of against that. I'd rather have more of a dry or not too affected signal. You know, it's a good level and that's about it. But as far as to keep the track or not, I did learn that part, that if it's not a good performance, it doesn't really matter what happens with the guy with the faders. If you didn't sing with the, and you wanted, you're not going to make from, hey. So I think that, I definitely was of the school of thought. You know, and also because a lot of my recording, I did just, at some point, after getting kicked out of too many bands, it's like, I'm just going to use Pro Tools and record myself because no one else wants to. But, you could be honest with yourself and go, that sucked. So that wasn't so bad. It wasn't good. So, I think you sort of can get good at throwing out ideas or tracks. So I'm more of a commit when it's a good one, and if it's not a good performance, it's out.
Tom, you probably get a bad rap for this as Avid. We've made Pro Tools that people do this kind of neurotic performance and production. How do you feel?
It's actually one of my favorite topics, believe
it
or not.
Let's talk about it.
So let's go back to, say, Steely Dan before Pro Tools. They were neurotic and did some insane editing type things on hi-hats. I've heard stories of, Gary probably knows them better, but just like down to the individual hi-hat hits, trying to move them around and stuff. So, look, if it wasn't Pro Tools, it could be anything, but there was something magical about taking these 16 backing vocals and saying, hey, we're burning it down to two tracks. Yeah. This is the mix. Everybody cool? We're now erasing those other tracks. We're moving on. And in the days of, hey, you got one or two tracks to play a guitar solo, I'm punching you in. Oops, sorry, I erased that part. We're going to have to go back and do that again. Now, that being said, Pro Tools is very freeing because you can do a lot of fix-it type things and don't have to make decisions. But I still think it comes down to discipline as a producer or someone guiding the project that, no, 72 guitar solos and sort it out later is completely not acceptable. Right, it really isn't. There's nobody has time or should have time to do that kind of thing. And I will say this: I'm a very bad singer. I enjoy doing some of my own home recording and stuff. So for me, Pro Tools, Auto Tune, and EQs to fix it and compress it and massage it, I think it's a good thing for the average bear. But it's like anything else; you can over abuse it.
I agree.
Sir, you've made lots of albums.
Yep.
Are you committing at the? You talked about your air band and stuff, so you must have been getting it right in the mic before you even hit the tape or even Pro Tools.
Well, with the C12, I don't necessarily use the air band on it. I wouldn't. But if I were using it on a snare, you bet, and I'll commit in the preamp that setting that I want on that snare.
I'm a big fan of printing.
And I'll commit it.
EQ or compressions at some level. Maybe not like you're saying, Colin. Yeah. Not overdoing it.
But then, when you're dealing with a vocal, and I'm talking about just from if I have the chance to be the producer and help that artist to make it through it, the main thing that I work on when I'm working with them is to get them to go through the song and sing it with the heart. And you'll go back and find that you will pull tracks if they do it four times or five times. You'll pull tracks from the first, you know, cuts from the first take that had the feel in it. And they can just work it into the ground.
That's right.
And so I like to keep it down as, you know, at least under 15. No, I'm just kidding.
Can I say, because
but you know what I'm saying. Get the people to give you the performance and do all you can as an engineer to make them want to perform it. I remember one thing I learned from Dave Reitzis, who's here with us today. He told me, I want you to remember, it's not about you as the engineer. It's about how that singer and that artist feels out there and how you make them feel when they're doing that cut. And he... They're, here these amazing vocals come out because they're in a place they belong and the place that they know you're on their side helping them to get it.
And I'm sure we've all seen producers who don't follow that. And, you know, they let the singers blowing down the first few words. And I stop. Let's punch it in there. They didn't even warm up yet, right?
I'm in red on rehearsals, you know, and, you know, because you have to get a performance out of people. Yeah. And so it's... You know, you just can't beat up a singer for 4 hours. You're just not going to get anything. And so, you know.
Well, the amount of times I've done the test vocal as the final vocal because it was the best performance out of all of them. Because I record everything. I say, listen, I'm just checking your mic now, but I even record that. And often that's the vocal that ends up on the track. Because by the time you get them stressed out with the red light on, you won't get a performance out of some vocalists. So, yeah. Can I say, though, if you think this industry is bad, you should see the way the film industry is going now, that guys are just pointing cameras and then hoping to fix it later in post. And it's...
That's why we have no music budgets, because they've done all that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's another discussion. Yeah,
and they ate too much while they were out there filming.
Here's one. You can go last on this. This is Joseph from Paris. Are control services just for some... I'm going to start with you, Gary, because you love these things. Are control services just for some people, or do you think all my recording consoles will one day be replaced?
Well, I came up with consoles. I organize with consoles. I am going to use consoles. And there's a lot of great records that are made. Consoles aren't being used. Guys are using a mouse, and that's what they're used to. And so it's really... just what you're used to. I mean, great records are made without consoles. I just can't get a mix up.
So when you say console, do you mean actual audio passing through the console or control surface?
No, control surface.
What we're saying is, do you think, so you work without, you can work without, any, you, there's not a Neve board or an SSL in front of you, it's Pro Tools through a control surface for you?
It is for me, that's correct. Yeah, if the automation is Pro Tools, I want to use a control surface that's going to do it. I did it for so many years where I was using one console. I was using Pro Tools because I didn't know it yet. I was using it as a multi-track. Then I realized how stupid that was. And then, you know, because you're locked into the console's automation, you know, it's a, you know, as you get older, you just either go with it or you don't go with it. And so, you know, I've chose to always jump onto the technology to just...
So you're fully over now? You're not working on analog consoles?
I'm over myself, yeah. With analog, yes. I'm a dig guy.
I'm over you, too.
I'm here.
Best friend now. Cliff, how's it work with you? Because we're all Pro Tools fans on this panel.
Absolutely.
Do you think that control surfaces are one day going to be the way? And the people will go, do you remember those things called mixing desks?
Yeah. I don't know. I think that there will still be some of them around. But I do know that I haven't had the experience with the control surfaces. I do have the console, but I mix in the box most of the time. And I use the console to get the sounds into the box. So if I had a control surface and I could afford to go that route and make that happen for me, I could learn how to use it, and I'm certain I would love it because I love the feel of the console.
We'll talk afterwards.
Yeah. No, but you know what I'm saying, don't you? I mean, I haven't had the education for it, you know, and I didn't have the budget to be able to put it in the room. And so I'm certain that's where it is heading.
Colin, you're a guy that makes plugins that replace so much hardware. Do you think control surfaces are going to be just the thing of the future? Is it?
I think it'll still be a mixed bag because music is very subjective. And when you're that person who hasn't quite made your hit record, and then you make that record that gets you a lot of work, if you used, like, if you had like a hamster in a cage, you know, powering your, you know, mixing console, that's what you would do, because you wouldn't want to change whatever that secret sauce was that you came across. You would just stick with it. And if it was with a console or a control surface, it almost just wouldn't matter to you. It was like, that's what was in the room at the time. I wore a green jacket, I had on my NAMM mag shirt, and I had a banana for lunch. And so that's what I do every day I go in the studio. Every day.
I love you, Colin.
And, but that's what they would do. But if as you know, time goes forward, if more and more people use control surfaces, then yeah, the trend will go that way. But when people find what works, it does not matter, because if that's what got you that sound, that thing, and that you're the guy with the sound and the thing, and people ask you, how'd you do that? And you're like, you tell them, I got this hamster in a cage. It's bananas. What? And they're like, what? You're like, sorry, I got to go. Like, just lunch break. And so
You do not disappoint being on this panel, sir. Tom, you're here.
I can't follow that answer.
I know, which is good in a way, because I know what your answer will probably be.
No,
know what your answer will be?
Actually, I always surprise you. So I study this subject quite intensively, as you can imagine. So we've done surveys.
Of course you did.
And about 20, I don't know, out of 2,500 professionals that we've surveyed over the past couple of years, 80% of them mix in the box all or most of the time. Of those same people, the amount that have an analog or digital console is very low, that actually have it. So that being said, to me, it boils down to workflows. And what do people do and how do they want to work? And Colin's point...
Bananas, it seems, for Colin.
I can't beat that right now. But I will say that the idea of flexibility and taking the automation with you... Is more important now than ever. I'm sure Dave works in multiple places. You have to move your mixes around. And control surfaces and in-the-box automation enable that flexibility and recallability. And the amount of tracks that engineers have to manage nowadays, the deadlines they have to manage, the budgets, to go to a studio that can afford to have an air conditioning bill for an SSL or a Neve, you know, and the electricity bill to support that.
Use Ferrari.
That's right. And then recall that mix. It's not practical in the workflow or fitting the modern sound engineer.
Budget
is a big part of it. So I think professional control surfaces enable professionals to be creative and use traditional interfaces to do that.
Because it sounds like what you were describing in your workflow is that people are using SSLs and Neves as channel strips.
Yeah, well, I believe that in some cases they are.
They just get using that as a absolutely get into the box and then out of that.
And it's what Colin was saying. They don't disrupt the thing that's been working for them. Yeah. You don't just change everything that's been giving you Grammys.
Unless the budget isn't available for the hamster.
If you can't
afford the hamster on the next record, you're going to figure it out.
I'd take the banana first.
Definitely. Hamster would slow me down.
Yeah, hamster would slow me down too. Gary, is there any questions from the floor? Because we're going to wrap up soon. Yes, sir. David, shout it in, then I'm going to repeat it for the tape. All right, I'm going to give that to Gary first, because I think that could get us all going nicely. Where do you see this industry going in the next 10 years, Gary?
The pro audio thing or music in general and stuff? More music is being produced now than ever. How's it being done? How is it getting out? Distribution channels are few and far between. You can distribute music yourself. I don't know. I just turned 60. I'll be 70 in 10 years. I hope to be doing this. I love doing it. I don't really know the answer, Dave. I just more people have to insist on music, good music, and that's a subjective statement right then and there. I don't really know, but we will be listening to music, that's for sure.
So let me put it another
way.
Let me put it another way. Are you optimistic about the future of our industry?
I'm trying to be. I'm really trying to be. It's a difficult challenge, but I think, you know, if you're a spirited person and you love what you do and you loved why you got into this, you'll find a way. You reinvent yourself every day. We're challenged with that. I have to reinvent myself every day. The business formats. Am I mixing live? Am I going to make a record? Am I scoring something? I just want to be a solution now. I just want to do it all. So I hope for all of us.
Tom, you're part of the future of recording in a sense, because you did we've talked about it already. You guys transformed the recording industry with Pro Tools. Are you optimistic? What's the future for you? Is it a good future for our industry, and optimistic about the way the industry is going?
It's funny that this question came up, because we're working on this initiative called Avid Everywhere, and it really is about changing the industry that we're living in and the workflows in a more positive way. And some of the first fence post of that is collaboration. So I believe in this future, Dave will be mixing parts for people all around the world who will be tracking and creating music in a much more
organic way,
collective way.
Yeah.
That will just, I don't even think we can sort of envision the possibilities there. And the second part of that is being able to monetize that. So musicians and Pro Tools people and sound creation people being able to come together in a community, in a marketplace that's part of Avid Everywhere, and find something that they're looking for, a track or a bass player or a part, whatever that will be, again, will bring people closer together and sharing this workflow. So I am very positive that the future it's going to be different, and we're going to have to stay on this thing together. We're starting this customer advisory panel that's for customers, by the customers, to help with standards and help Avid in direction of building software and such. And I really think that's a big part. I think everyone is going to have to chip in and work towards what the new future is for this industry. It's not going to get there on its own. It's complex, but I do feel positive.
Cliff, in the short time I've known you, I feel like you're the eternal optimist, not in a naive way, but you're the kind of person who really needs to believe in a better future. How do you feel about the future of this industry?
Well, I think the best song that was ever recorded is yet to come. I don't think the best song has been recorded yet. I believe that the greatest engineer, because of all the technology that's out here today and because of all the collaboration between engineer to engineer on the different sites where they can learn, your site in particular, and others, where they can learn from
the Garys,
the greats, the Garys, and from the Reitzes, and from all these great engineers that I respect and I've respected so much in my lifetime. They're getting so much information from them. Man, if I would have had that when I started out, yeah. I mean, it wouldn't have taken so long to get to where you're doing something that, you know, feels right.
And these guys, too, keep reinventing themselves and keep learning and growing. So it's a continuous process.
So the greatest are still out there, and they're these young guys
girls. I'm glad you're saying that, because, you know, if there is a legacy that we can leave, and it's something that I've been doing a very long time, you must give back. You must give your energy to the young kids. Sounds cliche, it sounds stupid, but, you know, I'm not the Beatles. I didn't invent music that way. I interpret everything that comes my way, but I try to give the energy to as many young people as I can. If it's their passion, they say, should I go for it? You're 20 years old. Why shouldn't you go for it? So that's the way I think about it now. I try to give as much back.
It's funny you say that. The reason that Pro Tools Experts started was I, 5 years ago, was thinking there's all these, I mean, looking at forums and people who can't do stuff, and I'd been sat by engineers like yourself who'd say, oh, you just do this, Russ. And I thought, he's shown me. And so I thought, if I can make videos like that to show not just one person but thousands of people what somebody showed me, then it's got to be powerful. And, well, as we say, we're 5 years on, and the rest is history, as they say. But you're right, is that passing it on is such an important part of legacy. And panels like this today where we're sharing our secrets, or whatever you want to call them. Colin, you can have the final word, which I'm sure will be unique, because we love you and your take on things. How do you feel about the future? You seem like the eternal optimist. It's like having Tigger at the show.
The future. Well, kind of like the NAMM show, we're all here together. And if we're collaborating over the internet and a Facebook page is integrated into your Pro Tools thing, or everyone goes back to analog and cut and tape, I think we're all sort of stuck here because we all like it. You know, why would I stand up for hours and look at obscure manufacturer's gear because it's awesome, and that's why you like it. And why do I obsess about snare tracks and vocals? It's because we all like to do this. So I think as long as we all sort of hang together, you know, when you can help somebody out, you help them out. When you can, you know, make your studio better, you make it better. When you, I don't know, just that collaborative way, not like talking with someone and sending an email, but I can get the hands-on thing from Russ, and then I can also go meet Russ at the show and talk to him and see what he's like. And oh, he's kind of a funny guy. He's really tall, but I get that, and it's all kind of come together because we are all stuck here because we like to do this. So if we can all hang together and work together and eat bananas and feed your hamster cage guy, it'll all be good. Just remember that we're all here because we like it. And we're all going to screw up, and we're all going to not screw up sometimes. So just, I don't know, eat more bananas. Did that help? I'm going
to It stop. Did help, yeah. But I have to say an enormous thank you to Gary Lux. And he's angry now, so go and talk to him, because you're going to get his passion. He's happy. Tom Graham.
It's good fun. Great.
If you lived in our country, Sir Cliff Marg. Senior, should I say. And the inimitable Colin McDowell. We love you, man. The Mean Green Machine. Thank you all for being here today. Thank you for being part of this recording. Thank you, RSPE. Thank you, Triad Orbit. Thank you for all the vendors in this room that have given up your time. We appreciate your giving up that time today. Thank you, everybody, and good night.